From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Mary Che, who is a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 3, who always seems to join us during our membership campaigns, but we'll talk more about that later. Joining us now is Ovita Wiggins, who is a Metro reporter for the Washington Post covering Maryland politics. Ovita, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Ovita, before we jump into the special session, gubernatorial candidate Wes Moore announced his running mate for next year's election. Who did he choose?
Wes Moore chose Aruna Miller, who's a former delegate and also former congressional candidate for the 6th District. And in choosing Aruna Miller, I think he gained some geographical diversity in his ticket. Moore is pretty well known in the Baltimore City region, but and that's where he's like picked up many of his endorsements. But with Miller, as I said, she's served two terms in the House of Delegates and represented Montgomery County and a former candidate. So she brings campaigning experience as well as geographical diversity to Moore's ticket.
Hi, Ovita. Tom Sherwood here. Montgomery County is center of the earth, it seems, for lieutenant governor candidates. Rashern Baker already has the name Nancy Navarro, who's term limited there in Montgomery County. And Peter Franchot from the state controller running for governor has named Monique Anderson Walker, who has resigned from the Prince George's Council, to be his running mate. The suburbs of Washington seem to be growing increasingly the place to be if you're going to run for something.
I think that's right. I mean, of course, voter-rich Prince George's County and Montgomery County will play a huge role in the upcoming election. And with someone like Moore, who is from Baltimore City and is pretty known in Baltimore City, but he's an unknown entity in the Washington region, I think it was many would describe it as a smart move for him to pick up Aruna Miller as his running mate.
All the candidates who are running in the primary have until February 22nd to name their running mate. Are we expecting any more during the holiday season?
That's a good question. I would imagine that we will see more making their selections over the next few weeks. I'm not sure if it'll happen before the holidays, though. But as you said, definitely have to have it before February 22nd.
Let's finally settle this argument that Tom and I have been having for years. Is Peter Franchot the comptroller or the controller?
I say comptroller.
Well, Tom just said controller. So.
He wants to be called governor.
That's right. I didn't know which. I didn't know who says comptroller or controller. Okay.
On to Annapolis. Maryland lawmakers held a special session this week. One of their priorities was approving a new congressional map in response to the 2020 census. Republicans, including Republican Governor Larry Hogan, have major issues with the map. What are their concerns, Ovita?
Well, their main concern is that the map that was approved by the legislature, they basically say that it has partisan gerrymandering, continues to be gerrymandered. Governor Hogan on yesterday called it one of the most egregious maps that he's ever seen, and actually described it as being worse than the map out of Texas, which the U.S. Justice Department has filed suit over. So that's their main concern. And Governor has said that this will end up in court. It'll be not only in state court, but also in federal court.
The congressional map, of course, is to make it more likely for the Democrats to have a fighting chance in the ward, in the District 1 that Andy Harris controls. But, you know, the governor there's an organization connected to the governor called the Fair Maps Maryland. Who is that? And apparently they're going to carry the legal fight to the courts.
That's right. It's made up of both, I've been told it's a grassroots organization, but made up of both Democrats and Republicans. And Governor Hogan said on yesterday that there will be residents who will carry that lawsuit forward.
Yeah, but the U.S. Supreme Court has said that, redistricting is basically a state function or a county local function, that it's not going to be involved unless there's some egregious racial discrimination or other overt anti-constitution type discrimination. I don't see that. I just see a lot of political maneuvering, which is what state legislatures do.
Exactly. It remains unclear, what will happen with the litigation. On yesterday, of course, Governor Hogan also called on the Justice Department to add Maryland to its lawsuit, the lawsuit that it filed over Texas's map.
If that happens, I'll be the most surprised person. If it's a U.S.
I don't think you'll be the only one who'll be surprised.
The Democrat-led legislature also overturned a few of Governor Larry Hogan's vetoes, including one having to do with the governor's involvement in parole decisions. Tell us about that.
Sure. This is a the governor vetoed the bill which would strip him and obviously future governors of having a final say in whether a person who is serving a life sentence is released from prison. This legislation has been around for decades, actually, ever since back in the mid-1990s when Governor Paris Glendening declared that life means life. And at that time, when he made that declaration, he basically told the parole commission to not send any more recommendations because he would not release anyone who was serving life sentences. That had, other governors sort of followed that same policy. And so over the last couple of decades, you would rarely see anyone released who had been sentenced to a life sentence.
And there, of course, is a racial dynamic to this, isn't there?
There definitely is. I mean, Maryland, which I think a lot of times it shocks people to hear, but Maryland has the highest percentage of black men who are incarcerated in the country and also has the highest percentage of those serving life sentences. So obviously, the black community has bore the brunt of this policy.
Ovita Wiggins is a Metro reporter for The Washington Post covering Maryland politics. Ovita, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Up next is Mary Che, who's a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 3. If you have questions or comments for Mary Che, you can start calling now, 800-433-8850. Send us an email at kojo@wamu.org, a tweet at Politics Hour, or you can reach us on Facebook at The Politics Hour. Mary Che, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tom Sherwood, before we get to D.C. politics, let's talk Virginia for a minute, because there's a recent recount that upheld that the GOP won in a contested Virginia House race. The significance of that, of course, is that it would ensure that the GOP gets a majority in the next Virginia House of Delegates.
Yes, the Virginia Democrats got walloped in the state delegate races, 100 seats. And there were two seats that were too close to call, and looked like, but the recounts allowed by law showed that both Republicans won. Both of the seats are in Hampton and Virginia Beach area, but the key point is that the Democrats lose control of the House, which they've only had for a couple of years, and Eileen Fillercorn, who's from Fairfax, will no longer be Speaker of the House. The first woman to be Speaker will be out as Speaker next month.
The other thing that happened, of course, is in the Virginia redistricting map, you have one member of Congress, Representative Abigail Spanberger, who is a Democrat, whose district has been redistricted. It, on the one hand, it may be good for her politically. On the other hand, it might not be that great for her geographically.
Well, Unlike Maryland, where the Democrats in the legislature figured out what to do for redistricting, in Virginia, their attempt at a nonpartisan or a bipartisan redrawing didn't work. And so the Virginia State Supreme Court got some people to draw maps. And Ms. Spanberger is now lives 50 miles outside of her 7th congressional district. She lives in Henrico County near Richmond. The 7th district has been moved up more to northern Virginia. She'll either have to move or run in the 1st congressional district, which is not very hospitable.
I think she's going to move.
Well, you know, 50 miles, you know, Henrico County to Stafford or Prince William. You know, those are Stafford and Prince William are some of the growing parts of the state. She would be in much more friendly territory if she moved. But there are politicians in Prince William and Stafford who might want that seat for themselves.
On now to Mary Che. Since we're talking redistricting, Mary Che, the D.C. Council gave initial approval to the redistricting map. I believe there are no changes to your ward, Ward 3. Is that correct?
That's right. We had looked at perhaps a little bit of tinkering up in Chevy Chase or maybe Foxhole, but it really didn't make a lot of sense because when you start tinkering on one part, you start to have a ripple effect on others. And given the lack of consensus for precisely what to do, we stayed where we were because we're right in the mean number for our population.
Madam Council Member, thanks for joining us today. The big change was that Ward 6, which is the Capitol Hill, Southwest Washington area, had grown so much that it had to change. And Ward 8 had not grown so much and needed more people. So the area around the ballpark, South Capitol and M Street, is now going to be in Ward 8. Do you approve of that change?
Well, yes, I do. I was very pleased with how the subcommittee proceeded. And it's unfortunate, you know, that folks move out of a ward and into another ward when they develop some allegiance to one ward or another. But by law, you know, after the census, we look at the population and the requirements for equal protection are that, you know, it's one person, one vote, or something relatively around that. And Ward 6 had really grown exponentially. Ward 7 and 8 were lagging in population. So to meet that requirement, there had to be movement. And while folks may not always, you know, welcome that, it had to be done because legally it's a requirement.
And there are issues about racial protecting minority representation and those types of things. But you made a proposal. I watched some of these endless hearings,
I have no life, but go ahead.
You have no life. But you made a proposal I thought was kind of a cool idea, which went nowhere. And you even held your hands up like you were shaping a clock. And you said, why don't we just shift all 8 wards a little bit so there will be more representation, black and minority representation in the white parts of the city, and just redo all 8 wards. That got zero response from the other council members.
No, I know. But, you know, so you get these opportunities sometimes. And it just seemed to me that although it would be a heavy lift, I appreciate that, we could have taken this opportunity to sort of like on a swivel to turn things and really more equitably integrate our wards. There was one comment about what I was saying that, well, you know, you want to have some wards where you can guarantee, you know, a minority majority for that ward. But I don't think that was really salient. I just think that it seemed too high a mountain to climb. But it is a lost opportunity, and I wish we had explored it.
There seems to be a debate over the Armed Forces Retirement Home in Washington Hospital Center, both currently in Ward 5, but the new map would put them in Ward 1. What are the concerns over that change?
Well, you know, I did try to listen to both Councilmember Nadeau from Ward 1 and Councilmember
McDuffie. I'll help you out here. We're from the media. We're here to
help.
There's
so many of you.
Okay. I did listen to it, and, you know, ultimately, and not to sound too harsh about it, it looked like a land grab by for potential for development by one ward over the other, because in neither case would the numbers, the population numbers, have made any difference. And you're not supposed to project population. You're supposed to take the population that you have based upon the census and decide it that way. So there was a tiff there for sure. But I thought that the Ward 5 council member had the better argument, and I voted for his amendment to leave that area in his ward. However, absent one member, his motion failed by virtue of not getting a majority. It was a 6-6 split. So we're going to have a vote on that again, the second vote on that, and perhaps there might be a change. But that's the way I saw it anyway.
Yeah, there are two big land masses there, but the issue is not the land mass, but as you referenced, it's the development, the money, the contributions even that a council member might get if these areas are in his or her ward as development continues in those neighborhoods.
Yes, and I thought that that is not a proper basis on which we should have proposed a change. So we'll see what happens on the second vote.
Our guest is Mary Che, a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 3. Let's talk traffic, but allow me to begin with Santi, who sent us a message on Twitter. Could you please ask Councilmember Che whether she will push for widespread permanent installation of automated bus lane enforcement? DDOT has already piloted but hasn't permanently installed them.
Well, that's where we want to go eventually. So to the caller, yes, that is an objective, and it does dovetail into the conversation that we're having now. There are so many things that we need to do, both to move transportation more efficiently, but also to make sure that we're providing, safe lanes and protection for all of the users of the roads, and that's one of them. So, yes, it's piloted now, but the ultimate objective is to have those as permanent and once permanent and even now enforced. It's a key component of that.
Well, this is one of my irritations as a city resident.
This could go on for a while.
No,
go ahead.
I'm going to make it.
I always take this as a, your constituent services hour.
He is plagued by multiple irritants, but go ahead.
You know, every mayor has had something called Alley Palooza, where they rush out and they fix alleys. We need a pedestrian Palooza or a bike Palooza or an intersection Palooza. I don't understand why we know that we've had children killed, to be serious about it. We've had people of all ages killed on our streets. We have cyclists who have been killed because the bike lanes aren't strong and protected enough. We have any number of transportation issues in this growing city. Why isn't there any more? And we had Vision Zero, which is some people say is zero vision. Why isn't there just a more headlong emergency move to get the streets safer while it's less traffic on the streets now during the pandemic?
And I'll add this. Ward 1 Councilmember Brianne Nadeau came on the show last week to talk about improvements to traffic safety, and one of her big changes was to install raised crosswalks, and she voiced concerns about the slow pace in which Vision Zero policies are being implemented. You chair the Committee on Transportation and the Environment, and I'm going to put this question to you and ask you not to answer it until we come back from the break. But how would you respond to the idea that Vision Zero policies are not being implemented as quickly as they should? I'm Kojo Nabi. Welcome back to our conversation. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper, and we're talking with D.C. Ward 3 Council Member Mary Che and inviting your calls at 800-433-8850. Mary Che, before we took that break, I posed a question to you.
Well, I couldn't agree more that we have to act more quickly. You know, Vision Zero, it's easy to say that, that's zero vision or whatever you said someone
that was
tweeted.
Me.
But okay. But the idea is to have something to aim at, okay? And the aim here is to reduce serious injuries and deaths on the roads to zero, hence Vision Zero, by 2024. Unfortunately, despite many things being done, the fact of the matter is that our numbers have gone up in terms of people dying on the roads instead of going down. But there are supposed to be various components to this, and we need to work all of them at the same time. I mean, there are infrastructure changes. For example, you mentioned Councilman Nadeau wanted to have quicker action on, you know, these speed humps and that sort of thing on roads. But there are other things. There are bump outs for people to stand before they cross the street. There are other, you know, infrastructure things, but there are, traffic calming measures. There's education. But one thing that I was focusing on recently is the enforcement of our traffic laws, because if people are speeding or driving recklessly and they aren't held to account, then they're not going to change their behavior.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because it seems like there's a problem with D.C. enforcing traffic infractions. 633,000 vehicles could be booted in the district for having at least two tickets that have been unpaid for 60-plus days. But these vehicles are not being booted. What's going on?
What's not going on is the fact that we only have two crews in the Department of Public Works that, you know, really go out and use their license plate readers as they, you know, they travel around in different areas and they see if cars have more than two outstanding tickets that would make them boot eligible. And at the pace that they're going for the cars that are subject to being booted, we calculated that it would take 25 years to catch up with folks.
It's an imposition on the crews. I think there might be two crews of two persons each, and they can do mainly 50 cars a day if they work their butts off. But it goes back to my overall question that we know enforcement works. I cannot tell you the last time I saw a D.C. police officer writing a ticket for anything. They could.
Well, you know,
but why, I don't understand
this. Here's the
this.
Thing, though, Tom.
Okay.
Here's the thing. All those numbers, a lot of those are parking tickets or other kinds of tickets. I have asked that they segregate out those tickets that are for dangerous driver behavior, for example, speed 20 miles over the limit or, you know, running red lights. And then with that list in mind, because those are the ones I want to get at first, then we should use these license plate readers to identify those folks. And if there's no consequence, you know, if you're coming into the district and you're speeding and you race through a red light. I see it on Connecticut Avenue all the time where I am. People just, they run through the red lights, but they don't have to worry because if they're caught on the red light camera, which is what, and they are, they're not going to pay. They're going to get a citation, but they don't have to pay it. And they don't face any consequences because we don't have reciprocity with our neighboring jurisdictions.
There was controversy about that because the mayor's administration indicated that they had talked with the governors of Maryland and Virginia about doing reciprocity, and it turned out they really hadn't, that there'd been some lower-level staffing. Again, given the dangerousness of public transportation as we allow bikes and pedestrians and other forms of transportation, scooters, why isn't there more of an urgent response? That's what I guess I'm saying.
Sometimes it's hard to figure that out. For example, the Vision Zero measures that the law requires be taken and taken with some speed weren't funded in the mayor's budget. And in fact, it was only because there are going to be a whole lot of more automated traffic cameras put out that I put in the Budget Support Act that any money generated from that should go to all of these efforts that we're trying to make. And maybe that'll speed things up. But there are things we can do. I can't fully explain, Tom, the inattention to the enforcement piece of this. For example, the director at the hearing I had seemed surprised to have learned only recently that, in fact, there was some money in the budget to increase the boot crews. And then we find out that there's no coordination between the people who are giving the tickets, parking tickets, and the boot crews. In other words, they could tell straight away if somebody is boot eligible and could identify them.
Excuse me for interrupting you. One of the issues is some people have said is that you have the Department of Transportation, which designs the streets, and then you have the Department of Public Works, which handles ticket writing. Why isn't there a coordinated effort to put those together?
And allow me to have Mike add his question to that. Mike, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thanks. And thanks for having Councilmember Che on. And thanks, Tom Sherwood, for accurately identifying Mayor Bowser's Zero Vision program. I've been trying to get street signs posted with the 20-mile-an-hour speed limit that was put in a year ago in its final legislation, the Vision Zero Enhancement Omnibus Amendment Act of 2020, which had a provision that the speed limit on streets classified by the District Department of Transportation is local.
And what have you been hearing from the Department of Transportation?
Well, Director Lott didn't know that that was the case when I've talked to him. And they recently came back with the official word through their public announcement office saying Section 8 is one of the many sections of the Vision Zero Enhancement Omnibus Amendment Act that does not apply until the date of inclusion of its fiscal effect on an approved budget and
bottom line plan.
They say it hasn't been funded, so they ain't going to.
There we go. Mayor Che?
No, but wait a minute. That's what I was trying to tell you. It wasn't funded in the budget that came over from the executive. But then, because there's going to be this revenue in the future, the mayor couldn't take that and spend it for something else because it doesn't have a specificity. And so the chief financial officer wouldn't allow that to be allocated. But what I put in the legislation coming from the council is, to the extent any money comes in from those additional cameras, all of that is supposed to go toward the provisions of the Vision Zero Act that we enacted. So there's going to be a little bit of a time lag because those extra cameras have to be deployed, and then the monies that are generated from that will be devoted. But that came from the council. You're right. The caller's right. The budget was anemic in terms of anything put in there to finance the Vision Zero requirements.
I have one last question on this, because we could do the whole hour on this.
Yes,
subject.
And I have a specific Ward 3 question, yep. But go ahead first.
On the cameras, and the mayor had a press conference and she talked about enhancement of enforcement around school zones with some officers patrolling the morning and the afternoon. But it seemed like not nearly enough for all the schools we have. Why isn't there some simply thing this? Why aren't all the intersections around our schools traffic cammered so that anybody, because we have the speeding around these schools every day, and it'd be simple to have traffic cameras around the schools. That could be done. You could order it, and you could tell DDOT to put them up.
Mary Che?
Well, that is something that certainly could be done, and we could do it. But again, Tom, I have to tell you, unless we're committed to enforcing the citations that will be generated from those cameras, then it's
right. I agree
with
you.
Useless.
I agree with you.
But well, yes, I mean, that's one thing we can do. Now, the executive moved, and finally the council approved, of putting the issue about where cameras will be located, putting that, instead of in MPD, over in the Department of Transportation, so that they could have control of that. And I'm waiting to see where these cameras will be deployed. One of the things that they've started doing ineffectively so far is to put stop sign cameras out without full notice to folks. So a lot of folks don't know, and this is a public service announcement for everybody. If your front tires go over that painted bar at the stop sign and you stop after that, that's a citation. That's an ineffective stop. And certainly you have to come to a complete stop, and the cameras are very sensitive, not a rolling stop or even anything like that. And there has to be notice that there's a camera there. What we want is, and I can't say this often enough, I don't really care about the money that's generated from this per se. What I care about is people following the law. So we want people to understand, and we want these cameras to operate ultimately as a deterrent to violating the law. Stay within the speed limit, don't run the red lights, and don't run the stop signs.
Well, our reporter Jordan Pascal says, I think 20-mile-per-hour signs should have all been installed by the end of 2020. Was that supposed to be the case, Mary Che?
Yes, I think that's correct. And I do see them going up.
This is 2021, however.
No, I know, but it's slow. It's very slow. Welcome to government. I mean,
right.
You've been around a long time, and I assume you still share the frustration that I have is, that we prescribe that something be done, that a report be made, that an action be taken by a certain date. And, you know, I wouldn't say rare, but not as often as it's supposed to happen do we have people complying with these deadlines.
I've been around so long that I remember as a reporter when my car used to get booted quite frequently because of parking tickets on reporting assignments. But Katie tweeted us, please ask Councilmember Che about the Ward 3 housing justice proposal for the Wardman Hotel and bringing lots of deeply affordable housing toward Ward 3.
Well, you know, I was just on a meeting with the Washington Interfaith Network and others about affordable housing. We made some changes. The council made some changes in the comprehensive plan to allow greater density in Ward 3. And we also have certain areas of potential development at Chevy Chase, at Friendship Heights, and the Wardman property. So we're going to do, you know, everything we can to try to make sure that there is affordable housing included in all of those projects, because Ward 3 has a need to provide these units in Ward 3 to make living here more affordable, both, you know, affordability for workforce, but even deeply affordable units. So there's definitely a commitment on our part to do that.
Is there, I don't want to get into the weeds on zoning, but is inclusionary zoning in effect for that property? Or?
Yes, and okay. that will be used, but there are other levers too. There are other levers to get, you know, when we're talking, if it's private developers, you know, we need to work with them and offer them incentives, and that's what we intend to do.
Well, let me take the Tom Sherwood role here, because since we've last had you on the show, more candidates have declared they're running for mayor. This is the Politics Hour. Mayor Bowser is seeking a third term, and council members Robert White and Treon White are also seeking the Democratic nomination. Who are you supporting?
Well, I'm just waiting to see how the group develops, and I'm holding my fire for the moment.
You're running for re-election. You're running for your fifth term. I find it hard to believe that you've been there so long. But
I find it hard to believe, too.
Can we ask a COVID question since you won't answer the politics question? Mask. I think you were among the council members who sent a letter to the mayor objecting to her ending the mask requirement. Just recommending it, as opposed, just today, the governor of New York is reestablishing the mask requirement, and there's concerns that with the Omicron variant and the Delta variant, which is still raging, that jurisdictions may have to go back to mask. Where are you on this?
Well, I am where I was when we sent the letter, which is to say, I thought that lifting the mask requirement on indoor activities was a mistake. It was a mistake in terms of timing. I at least wanted us to wait until after the holidays are over and people are traveling and that sort of thing and see where we are with our numbers. I thought it was premature. And I do think that, you know, now more than ever, it may be necessary to go back to it. I do understand some of the mayor's thinking. Some of her thinking is that, you know, unless we open up a little bit, you know, we'll never get the downtown back. We may never get it back the way it was anyway. But she tried to do it, I think, with some care to keep recommending mask wearing, but to open it up a little so that, you know, if we ever can do this, we can begin to get back to some normalcy. But I disagreed with it then, and I still disagree with it.
Well, along with 11 of your colleagues, you voted to give initial approval to a bill that would require COVID-19 vaccinations for district students by March 1st. Why do you support that measure?
I support that because I think, you know, it's for the health of all of us, and mostly the children themselves. I think we need to have these vaccines just like we have many other vaccines, you know, for mumps and measles and whatever else. It's a vaccine that we need to keep kids safe. Now, I will point out that it's only fully approved vaccines, you know, for all age groups. And right now, I think that's, you know, the older teenagers. Ultimately, it'll go down to the lower ages. I think we absolutely need this. If we're going to get control here and we're going to, you know, protect our children, we have to do that, just like we do with other mandatory vaccines. It'll be no different than that.
Last week, we had your colleague, Brianne Nadeau from Ward 1 on, and she was talking about her legislation to stop the mayor's programs to clear homeless camps in the city. It was a somewhat contentious conversation. Some of the advocates who tweeted about it later thought we weren't sensitive enough to, you should just put people in housing, not clear the camps. You were opposed to that, and the council did not take up the legislation, postponed it, I think, to a coming meeting. What is your view on the city's, the mayor's efforts to clear homeless shelters, encampments in the district, and not doing fast enough housing for all the people who might want it?
Well, you know, as I said at the time, and I'll just raise it again, how could it be better for people to go through the rigors of winter in a tent rather than being able to get a hotel room or an apartment? How could that be better? How could it be better for folks to live, in some cases, in squalor, where there may be violence and there have been fires and other, you know, sort of untoward environmental experiences of living in these tent encampments? How can that be better than getting services and having a bed to sleep in at night? I don't see the logic of stopping this. Now, some of the folks are saying, well, but they're not really engaging with the folks who are being moved. From what I can tell, and I've very recently been, in conversation with the city officials who are in charge of this, and they're telling me that they are engaging, they are finding places for people to stay. So tell me why we should stop that in favor of letting people stay in these circumstances that I think are unhealthy, and in some cases might, you know, include other dangers, like, and we've had fires and we've had violence and we've had, it's, we can't do that. We have to get people into regularized
services. There's a fire last night on a tent in Foggy Bottom, but that's all the time we have. Mary Che, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, and thank you for having me. Have me back again, and we can do tattoos maybe.
Okay, well, thank you for your tattoo and your support of the Politics Hour and WAMU.
Okay, take
Mary
care,
Che,
you guys.
Is a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 3. That's about all the time we have. Tom Sherwood, I do have to say this. You know, our friend Mark Plotkin deceased a little more than 2 years ago. He was a guy who recruited me for this job. He also spent a great deal of time raging against Major League Baseball because one of his favorite players, Minnie Minoso, was not inducted into the Hall of Fame. Minnie Minoso was a rookie in 1951 and a favorite in Chicago of the Chicago White Sox. Now he's in.
Yeah. Oh, I'm shocked. The Mark Plotkin was raging about something. I think I still have not gotten through the list that Mark had of what he would rage about. He makes me look like a piker.
But now that Minnie's in the Hall of Fame, Mark is now resting in peace. I'm Kojo Nam.
The Politics Hour with Kojo Namdi is produced by Sydney Grannon. Our managing producer is Ingalisa Schrobsdorf. Today's engineer was Kenny Pierog, and our broadcast engineer is Rashad Young. Our phone screener is Bruce Romer. Mana Kashvi oversees all the content we make here at WAMU. For past shows, visit thepoliticshour.org.